Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Dan Silverman, who I am proud to say is a graduate of the French Culinary Institute. And as you know, now we're called the International Culinary Center, ICC, and we're sitting at ICC in Soho. So you may be hearing some of New York in the background. But anyway, let me tell you a little bit about Dan. I want to say I know a bit about Dan because he did graduate here, and he, in fact, has received one of our prestigious awards, Outstanding Alumni. So we're very, very proud of him. But he is a local boy. He grew up in New Jersey, and he lives in Brooklyn now. But his after he came to FCI, in fact, before he came to FCI, he actually was an English major, and He graduated from, I'll ask him a bit later, but he does have a literary background. But he, like a lot of people, was a career changer, came here. While he was here, right out of school, he went to work for David Boulay, which I think is maybe the most defining influence on his career from what I've observed. We're going to get into that in a little bit. And then he went to that famous Allison on Dominic that was taking New York by storm at that time in Tribeca. We're talking back in the 80s. He became one of the very first Food & Wine's best new chefs. And when he was at Allison, he got Gourmet's prestigious 20 top tables. From there, he became the executive chef of the Union Square Cafe in its real heyday when it was the trendsetter on shopping at the market at Union Square there. And then he went on to really take on his own persona at the newly opened Lever House, which was, you know, across from the Four Seasons on Park Avenue. Everybody was saying, oh, how can it stand up to the challenge? And Dan just took it and got it a Michelin star and was nominated as the best new restaurant by the James Beard Foundation the following year. He has really been able to put his own mark. And so then when the next hot thing came, when Andre Balazs opened the Standard down in the meat market, which was the benchmark and made the meat market the trend it is right now, he asked Dan to be the chef at the Standard Grill. And he got great accolades there. It's impossible to get into. I know he tried calling a couple of times to get in. No, I actually had to call Katie Ford to get me in. Anyway, now he is on a new venture at the Regency Hotel, and we're going to talk about that a little later in the program. So welcome, Dan. It's really great to have you back.
It's good to be back at school.
You know, I loved when you said you were here when it was a one-room schoolhouse. I love that. So tell us about being raised in New Jersey, the Garden State, and now you're such a market-to-table.
The Garden State. Well, I was born in Jersey City. And right around high school time, a little before, we moved out to South Orange, which is in Essex County, which is only 20 or 30 minutes away from the city. I mean, I can recall, you know, a lot of the towns in the area, there were still farms. And now, they've all, as gentrification, urban sprawl has happened, a lot of those farms have gone away. But there are still a lot of farms in the Garden State, which is a great thing. Left New Jersey, went to college, went to Vassar. When I got out of school, I did graduate with a degree in English Literature. That's why I'm a chef.
A chef who's very articulate.
Right. I can write complete sentences, and my spelling is pretty okay.
Tell me about the college years. Wait a minute. We're not.
Oh, okay. We're not going to skip that.
Yeah, I want to go. Why did you study English literature? What did you love about it? Did you love being at Vassar?
College was great. I had made great friends there. It was a great, stimulating environment. I always loved to read. I always loved to write, and I thought that perhaps I could take that interest and channel it into a creative career based on, you know, those interests and skills. And I worked in publishing for a couple of years. After college, I was an assistant editor at G.P. Putnam. And that was back in the day when you actually, you know, so many professions have changed, but that was back in the day when people actually sent envelopes full of pages of
manuscript.
Of script, yeah, that you would read through, and you'd actually write people letters, you know, expressing interest or, you know, politely declining their...
Do you miss those days? I mean, you know, do you think that we're missing something now?
Do I miss the print days or do I miss publishing?
No, not when you were... No, that kind of old tech where somebody would mail something and you'd actually read it, you'd have
I do miss that. And, you know, I was having a conversation with my chef de cuisine and my sous chefs last week about how people go about looking for work in the business. And back in the day, if you wanted a job at a restaurant, there was no such thing as Craigslist. You know, I suppose Microsoft Word was something that I wasn't entirely aware of in the 80s. And you actually created a resume on a piece of paper and you went to a restaurant and you knocked on the back door and you spoke to the chef. And that's how you got a job. You know, you interviewed with the chef, and then...
So let me ask you, people don't do that anymore?
People don't really do that anymore, no. It's all...
Email?
You know, it's all email, yeah.
So if somebody shows up at your door, does that make them more likely to maybe get the job?
You know, it's interesting. You would think maybe it would, but now because of all the communication technology that we have, I get a little shy of people who just walk in the back door.
Oh.
A little TF appointment. Sometimes. I mean, it depends, because I'm often quite busy. And
sure.
Unless I have the time blocked out, it's very difficult for me to break away and see some random person, which is actually kind of weird, because you would think, I don't know, I need to work on that one, I think.
I think later in the program we can go back to that, yeah. About what other responsibilities does a chef have to do today,
yeah,
that Andre Sultner didn't have to do 25 years ago.
Right.
And could, between services, sit down and talk to somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, conversation has been supplanted by emails and by texts and all of that. And I suppose that, you know, something gets lost. I mean, I guess you gain something. We've gained some things, but I think we've lost some things as well.
So when you were at Vassar, what was your favorite? Who was your favorite professor? What was your favorite class?
Oh, my God. My favorite professor was an English literature professor. He was Irish, actually. Eamon Grennan, who's a poet.
Oh.
Who was a great, great teacher in, you know, great classes. And
can you remember something he taught you? Does it stay with you today?
No, honestly, I can't. I just remember enjoying the experience.
Mm-hmm. Was he teaching poetry?
He was teaching, you know, he taught a number of things. He taught literature, he taught poetry. Mm-hmm. I remember taking a poetry workshop with him. I mean, I feel like poetry and cooking are not dissimilar.
I think you're
trying to distill, you know, you're trying to, in a poem, you're trying to get it, convey a sense of a thing or an emotion or, you know, some experience. And I think that when you cook, it's a similar aesthetic, although translated, you know, you're not using words, you're using ingredients and trying to build a complete thought of some sort, mm-hmm, whether you're trying to come up with something new. Mm-hmm. And I have to put new in quotation marks because there is no such thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, trying to make a statement that's uniquely your own, mm-hmm, and has, you know, expresses your sensibility, works with, you know, all of the ingredients coming together to create a complete thought. And so in that way, I think it's kind of similar.
Great analogy.
So, thank you.
So it's like someone reading a poem and maybe not getting the same feeling that it was written in. How do you feel about the people that eat your food, you know, to extend the analogy? Because they all, some people, you know, they're having a business meal and they don't even, they're not even conscious.
Right, well, eating.
And other people are analyzing every bit of it and passing it around. So you've got the extremes. How right. do you like people to approach your food in
like,
that sense?
I would hope that they enjoy it. And, you know, working in this business for a long time, customers use restaurants for all different reasons. Some people, it's just a convenient place to meet. Other people, you know, in my family, you know, we're constantly thinking about, you know, when the next meal is, what it might be, debating it, trying to, you know, figure out the shopping part of it, you know, so I understand that there are people like us, and then I understand that there are people who, you know, just need to get some nourishment, and I just hope that, you know, however they use it, mm-hmm. that it's delicious and it's satisfying.
So let's get back to your first family, your parents, and did you have siblings? And
I have a sister.
Yeah.
I mean,
food
and again, similar. Yeah, I think that, you know, we would often have discussions about, you know, what are we gonna have for dinner? What, you know, what's that gonna look like? You know, who's
Did you travel much when you were a kid?
We did. We did get to travel. We got to we traveled to London, traveled to Paris. I remember going to Paris as a kid, and always I love Paris. It's a great city to walk around in. I'm endlessly fascinated by it. Mm. I love all of those European cities: London, Paris, Barcelona, Rome. Great cities to just walk around and pop
Eat.
Into a little yeah. Constantly.
Yeah, that Boca Ria in Barcelona. So you got out of Vassar, and any particular reason you went to Vassar versus anywhere else?
Well, I went to Vassar, among other reasons, because my mother did.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'm what's the right word? I'm
a legacy.
I'm a legacy.
You're a legacy.
Yeah. My sister actually went as well. Uh-huh. It was just a really great school.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is a great school.
Not far away yet.
Yeah, far away.
Far enough away.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. You know, it was challenging academically. It was great socially.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So you get out of school, you're in the publishing trade, you're working in the city,
yes.
I take it. What made you say, I want to go to cooking school, or I want to become a chef? Was there a moment, or was this something growing in you?
Well, I think, you know, working in publishing, I didn't get the business component of it so much. I thought it might be a more creative endeavor for me. And, you know, ultimately it wasn't. And it wasn't satisfying, really, on an emotional level for me. And I was thinking, okay, well, you know, what can I do? What, you know, what's the next step for me? Not, you know, I'm not that old. I mean, I wasn't at the time. I was in my early 20s. And I knew I wanted to do something else. And the idea of law school wasn't too appealing at that point. Not that I don't regret that decision, but it could have been interesting, perhaps. And I thought, you know, I've always enjoyed cooking. I had jobs during the summer, you know, washing dishes, doing various things in restaurants. Really enjoyed reading cookbooks, and I still do. And I thought, okay, well, you know, why don't I try this? And I picked FCI because it was 6 months and then off to work. And I think the thing about school is, you know, if you're smart, you use school to figure out the wealth of things that you don't know that you need to learn. School is great because it offers you, you know, it offers you a great introduction to a lot of facets of whatever it is that you're going to school for. If it's cooking school, you get to see a bunch of potential avenues to explore. But the important part is to come out of it and get a job somewhere. And that's where the real learning, I think, begins,
right?
Because this profession is a lifelong.
Well, you
it's
know,
a lifelong
if you look
journey.
At it as a trade, the school part is like your apprenticeship, when you're learning the basic techniques.
Exactly.
And then, in order to become really a professional, in Europe, in the guilds, you needed to be a journeyman, which meant going into the trade and doing all the various steps to
right.
get to be a professional, not even a master, because
right.
then the professional has to spend years before they become the master.
Right.
So I you know, I think we've gotten away from that with our school system, where you learn everything in 2 years and 4 years, and you come out and they give you a master's degree, you
yeah.
know, like, and you, all you've
agree.
Done has been in school, you know.
Right.
So I think you've hit it, that your real learning starts when you start your journey, and you become a journey.
Yeah, that's a better way to put
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's the term they use in Europe. So, so anyway, so your journey was incredible, because you started with David Boulay. David is still one of the most wildly creative chefs working out there, and he's relentless in pushing himself. What was it like coming out of school and going into such an intense kitchen?
It was fantastic. I mean, I think I was really lucky to land there when I did. I think he just opened a month or two before I started. And I actually started before I was done with school.
Was David Ott there?
David was there. David,
yeah, so, 'cause I know David was one of his...
David, I think I had been working there for... I mean, I'm a little unclear on the chronology right. of that point, because it was
yeah.
a bit in the past now, but yeah, David came back. David had worked with David Boulay at Montrachet.
Right. Because I know that would
people.
Be the early years, because
yeah.
David told me he had to put up the ceiling in the old Boulay.
Yep, yep.
Everybody had to work on the construction.
Yes,
did you,
yeah.
Were you any
No,
part
I
of
wasn't.
That
I was. I started after the restaurant had opened, so it was
you were
constructed.
Lucky.
Maybe. I mean, I think that ceiling, that dining room is beautiful, and I would love to learn some of those skills.
Right.
But, I mean, that was done by David's brother.
Right.
Did a lot of that work. It's just right. a gorgeous, gorgeous room. There was
no.
nothing like that in New York at that
no.
point.
No.
It was a beautiful dining room. And landing in that kitchen was an enormous challenge. And, you know, coming out of school, you know, having devoured cookbooks and been in school, I thought I had some skills, and then to go into that kitchen and to realize that I had no skills was an eye-opener.
How did he tolerate you?
You should ask him. I mean, it was great. It was a challenge, and I was really terrible for, you know, the first few months. I would go home every day and think, my God, I suck.
So there's a lot of young cooks listening to this program, and our students here,
right.
they love this program. What can you do to prepare yourself to go into that kind of kitchen out of school? Or what can you do to up your skills? Is there anything, or do you just have to jump into the pool?
I think it's both. I think you jump into the pool. I think that, you know, again, school shows you a lot of things, but once you begin your journey, like, once you've been shown how to do something, that doesn't mean that you know how to do it. And I always tell my cooks that cooking is learning from your mistakes. I mean, you need to make mistakes. You need to do the same thing over and over again to see how products work. You know, whether you're making an omelet, whether you're roasting a chicken, whether you're making Genoise, whether you're making Hollandaise. You know, if somebody shows you how to do it and you do it that way perfectly 10 times, I would still argue that you don't know how to do it, because you haven't, you know, you haven't seen, if you're making Hollandaise, you haven't seen the sauce break or had to deal with that, or, you know, whether you're, you know, pick anything, you know, the product is the same, you know, the product is the same, an egg is an egg, or, you know, a carrot is a carrot, or a chicken is a chicken, but throughout the course of the year, those products change. You know, we can look at tomatoes over their season, you know, and they just, as the season progresses, tomatoes become riper and riper. You know, some years there's more rain, so they become water balloons. Some years it's really dry and they're just sweet and concentrated. working with the products throughout a season, you get to see those changes and you get to drive that product through whatever preparations you make, and you learn about the products. And you know, what works one day might not work the next day because the product might have changed in some way. And you need to know that. And the only way you can know that or learn that is by making those mistakes and then figuring out
how to accommodate.
How to drive it. And you know, so for me, it's making the mistakes, accepting the responsibility for the mistake.
Good point.
And that, yeah, the big part, I think. And then reverse engineering whatever happened and figuring out where you took the wrong turn and moving on.
Was David Boulay very forgiving on mistakes?
No. No. So, but that's okay, too.
Yeah. So how did you learn in that environment with all that pressure? Are you watching the other people? Would he come and stand over you and show you?
No. I mean, he was looking at the whole forest, not the trees. But I think you have to push yourself, really. I mean, and I think I was really hard on myself. I was just saying, like, I would get done, I'd be like, oh my God, I'm so bad. How am I going to do this? And I would just go in every day and push myself.
How many hours a day were you working
there? Oh, a lot. I don't remember. It's easily 12 hours a day.
How many days a week?
Probably, I think it was six back in that.
All right,
back
I just
in the
want
day.
Everyone to hear this.
Back in the day, it was a six-day week, and you had one day off.
That's right. I want people to hear what dues are.
Yeah, and you know, and then I just recall a spate of time. You know, we were either short-staffed, or you know, there are parties when we're closed on Sunday, and I can recall working, you know, 2-3 months in a row without a day off, and you just, you know, you roll out of bed, you go to work, you do it, go out for a couple of drinks or what have you, go to bed, wake up, do it again.
I remember when Tony Bourdain came out with Kitchen Confidential, it was all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Jacques Pepin said to me, you know, that's somebody who doesn't become a chef because it's so damn physically hard and you're so exhausted that if you're really in this game, you know, in the real way, you don't have time. You do a little of that, but you can't do as much as that book said. Anyway, we're going to take a break here. Okay. We're going to come right back.
Today's music is by Dead Stars on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Dan Silverman, who is now at the Loews Regency Hotel, which we're going to be talking about in a little bit. Dan, we were just talking about your first job out of school, which was like going to Mount Olympus, I think. So how did you know when to leave Boulay or, you know, move on? And where did you go and what were you looking to? How did you craft your career?
Well, I actually left Boulay a few times. And
really?
Came back. Yeah, no, I did. I can't remember the exact chronology. I think first I went to France first in there.
Did he help you?
He did a little bit. I wound up, I worked at for Ariane Degant's father in Auch for a little bit.
Oh.
I worked also for Dominique Boucher, who had been the chef at Tour d'Argent, who had a place that was way outside of the town of Bordeaux. It was take the train from Paris to Bordeaux, then you take a little train to some little town, an hour's train ride outside of Bordeaux, and then drive through, you know, fields of, I'm not sure what it was,
yellow
15
flowers.
Minutes to, you know, this little gorgeous 30-seat restaurant where, you know, you get an order for fish, you pull a fish out of the walk-in, you scale it, you fillet it, get an order for duck, you pull a duck out of the refrigerator, singe the feathers off, gut it, roast it, turn vegetables.
So what kind of learning experience was that? I mean, you would think at Boulay, where he coined the depot cod phrase and so market-driven, and all of a sudden you're singeing feathers.
I mean, you see where he was coming. I saw where he was coming from, and you know what he was trying, the experience he was trying to recreate, and it was just amazing. And then going,
did it shock you to see that, or did you
no,
go there? Because
I went
of
there
it?
For that,
you
and
went
then
there?
And then on the way back, I spent a week or 10 days in Paris and maxed out my credit card and.
Ate like a foie gras duck.
Yeah, tried to, yeah, couple of big meals a day. And then when I came back, I went back to Boulay. And
let me, you know, in those days, every young, ambitious chef went to Europe. And when I say Europe, it was primarily France.
Yeah, at that point it was France.
And felt that you had to do that, you know, for that exposure. I don't hear anybody really doing that much these days. And if they're going, they're going to Mugaritz in Spain or, you know.
I mean, I think it's the same sort of, I think that is the same sort of experience just through the lens of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's important for a young cook, a young chef, to go abroad?
I think it's important for people to get information. And now that means something different than what it did in the late 80s and early 90s. Because at that point, you couldn't look at anybody's menu. You know, now if you want to look at menus, all you have to do is sit at a desk and open up a web browser and, you know, you can read all of the menu. You can read the menu at Mugaritz. You can read the menu at, you know, any Michelin 3-star restaurant in Italy, France, Sweden, anywhere. You know, you can look at the menu for St. John in London. Everything's online. But back in the day, you know, somebody actually had to bring you a menu.
Right.
For you to get this, you know, to get a sense of what people were doing. Mm-hmm. So I think it was, you know, at that point, it was way more important to be able to get out and see stuff. And now, you know, if you want to see, you know, if you want to see plates from, you know, El Bulli, which is closed, but all of this stuff is online. So, I mean, not that you're having the experience of eating the food, but the image is right there. So, it's different now. I mean, it is somewhat the same, but it's.
The difference is
dynamic.
So you came back to Boulay, and you felt a little more in control.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had more skills, and I had a vision of what the bigger picture could be, and you know, I think I was at Boulay for 6 years, off and on, maybe a little longer. Came back. I eventually worked all the stations in that kitchen, which was a great experience. But so let's see, France, came back, went to California, moved out to California for a while.
Oh, where did
San Francisco.
And where did you work out there?
Well, I really wanted to work at Chez Panisse, and I did do, but more as like a part-timer, because I was, you know, I had a friend who was working in the kitchen there and who told me that somebody might be leaving the restaurant kitchen. I thought, oh, great! You know, I love that part of the country. I can move out there. Why not? I have a skill that I can get a job. And you know, I worked at a bunch of places. I worked at Post Trio. I worked at Zuni Cafe. But all of my days off, I would pick up shifts at Chez Panisse, you know, just thinking, okay, you know, if people see my face, you know, I'm in there working, I'm doing a good job, perhaps I'll get that position when this person leaves. And every time I worked, see a new person working the line there, and they've all been there for a really long time, and it's an amazing place. There's amazing products, the cooking is wonderful, and
how are the kitchens different? I mean, David Boulay is as pristine about product as
right.
Alice is. So what's the difference between the two kitchens? Like, you know,
I mean, they're similar in some regards and completely different in others. It would be hard to quantify the differences. I think that Boulay's kitchen was obviously way more French and...
French meaning technique-driven?
And just the way it was set up. It was a big island. The kitchen at Chez Panisse was, you know, and clearly David had designed that kitchen. And it was a gorgeous kitchen, and it was a great, you know, it was a great room to work in. And the Chez Panisse kitchen was, you know, it's in that little building in Berkeley, and it was kind of like the four walls defined.
How much kitchen you could have.
Yeah, I mean, and not to say it wasn't a great kitchen, because it completely worked, but it was a different, you know, I went from doing, you know, 7, 9, 11 course tasting menus to doing this set 4 or 5 course menu, which was a great experience, and it was great to see those products in that place, and that was just incredible.
Is the attitude of the cooks different?
Well, I mean, there is a difference between New York and California, and I think there is a difference between working in, you know, a restaurant that's a pressure cooker versus experiencing that Northern California environment, but it was certainly, you know, you certainly wanted to do your best, and you know, it was wonderful working in a restaurant where the lettuce for the salad that was served for dinner at 7 o'clock at night got delivered at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Wow!
You know, and you know, it was picked just hours before that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great. It was great to be able to see that and to see all, you know, see the mushrooms from, you know, that day or the day before, or, you know, the local squab. So it was, in that regard, it was wonderful.
Mm. So how long did you stay in California?
I was in California for close to a year.
And then what brought you back?
Well, I never got that position at Chez Panisse.
Oh.
So I came back and I worked at Le Bernardin for a little while, and then I went back to...
Who was there then?
Abraham? No, it was
Gilbert
and Eric.
Eric had just started, okay.
Yeah. Okay. And then it just kind of worked out that I went back to Boulay and worked there for a chunk of time more. And then I left. It was just, you know, I think I'd soaked up everything that I could get out of that place. And I left, took a job doing something for a little while, and then I landed at Allison on Dominic, which was
Is that the first
awesome.
Time you could craft your own menu?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And it was interesting because, you know, you work at a restaurant like Boulay. You know, I can remember at one point being the AM sous and setting up the line, and I knew that I needed 25 small sauce pots just to start. You know, it's like all of this mise en place, all of this equipment. And then going from that kitchen to the kitchen at Allison on Dominic, which was, you know, a small line, not much larger than this window space here, with, you know, I think it was 14 burners, a salamander, tabletop fryer, 2 or 3 ovens, and that was it.
You're probably having, less than a quarter of a mile away from Boulay.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, and having to craft a statement that I could be proud of and putting it on a plate based on, you know, the physical constraints of that space was was interesting.
So why did you take the position?
It was a chef job, and it was, you know, it had a great reputation.
That's right. Tom
had put it on the map.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience.
So what was bursting in you to do on your first menu that was totally yours?
My God, I can't even remember now. I mean, I never, it's, you know, I wish I could remember. I just remember thinking how great it was to be able to craft things that were mine and being able to put them on a plate and being able to come in every day and say, okay, you know what, this isn't quite good enough. I want to rework this plate. And being the person in charge. I do remember my first lineup with the staff and thinking, oh my God, I'm so nervous. Why are these people listening to me?
But by that time, how many years had you been cooking?
Allison, I think I've been cooking for 7 years.
Okay.
So yeah.
You had really paid your dues to get where you were. And how long were you there for?
I was there for 5 years, I think.
5 years.
Yeah.
So this is not a guy who bops around. 6 years at Boulay, you know.
No, I'm not a big fan of that. I think that it gets interesting after the first year. I think that, you know, you learn by repetition, but also you just learn. And it's interesting to me what you learn after that initial, you know, that initial push.
Mm-hmm.
You do settle in and you get comfortable in a space, mm-hmm. but I think that you also, other challenges present themselves and you can continue to push and and try new things.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that regard, I think that, you know, over the course of time, I think I, you know, A, I learned how to cook within the confines of the small kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I think I figured that out. But it's just great to be able to play.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take another break right here, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Dan Silverman, and we're in his journeyman years before he's now recently at the Lowe's Hotel, the Regency, up on Park Avenue in 61st, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
61st. And we're going to get there, but now we're going to leave Allison. I think the next one was Union Square Cafe.
The next one was Union Square.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that is a real plum, you know, position to...
That was great. Was, yeah. I think I first connected with Danny at probably in Aspen when I won Food and Wine.
Mm-hmm.
That was 1997, I think,
mm-hmm.
which is a long time ago now.
Mm.
And I just stayed in touch with him, and when I left Allison, he reached out to me. We had a bunch of conversations. I met Michael Romano and Paul Bowles Bevan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about things, and this was at the point, I think, let's see, they were, 11 Madison and Tabla were open.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they were working on Blue Smoke,
mm-hmm.
and Danny was looking for someone who could back up Michael so that Michael could spend more time with Ken Callahan working on Blue Smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So I came on board, and I started as chef de cuisine there. And, you know, there was a bit of a learning curve.
Because
that place was, you know, Michael had really created a wonderful restaurant. And, you know, first, you know, I couldn't come in there and reinvent the wheel. The wheel had already been invented. You know, it was a function of learning what Union Square was about. and honoring that work, and making sure that all of the people who were, you know, regular customers of that place just enjoyed the experience.
That's true. It's one of those restaurants like La Coupole or Dôme in Paris where you go back for the standards.
Yeah.
The standard dishes. You can put specials on, you can do some things, but don't touch the standards, because that's, you know, it's kind of a standard restaurant.
Yeah. But, I mean, they gave me, you know, once that base was set, you know, it was great to be able to start to work in some of my, you know, some of my flavors and do some specials and get some things on the menu. And it was a wonderful experience. And the kicker was that the Union Square Market was right across the street.
Right.
And that was the best, going to work, getting out of the subway.
And then you would walk around the market.
I would just walk the market before I went to work, and you know, if the receivers hadn't picked up, you know, so and so's lettuce or guy's strawberries or whatever, just go across the street and get them. And that was the best, you know. Or I would walk, get out of the subway and hit the market and have an idea for something.
Hmm.
And
do your special. It's almost like Chez Panisse. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, it was. In a certain regard, it was like that. And it was awesome.
So after there
was Leverhouse.
Leverhouse. So tell me about that. That was such an incredible room. I mean, that was you know, it's a national landmark, isn't it? The building.
Yeah, the building's great.
So how did you go from Union Square to there, and what was the challenge?
Well, I mean, it was a whole different demographic. You know, obviously, Power Lunch, beautifully designed dining room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stunning architecture. Was a new kitchen. You know, I was lucky enough to get to pull a great staff together for that, and try different things and take my food in a different direction, in a different neighborhood. And it was just real, it was really exciting.
So where was your head in taking the food in another direction? What were you going to do?
I mean, at that point, I think, you know, it's still kind of a French aesthetic, although, you know, a year or so in, I did go to did get to travel to Spain, went to Barcelona, and I find that the rim of the Mediterranean, all of those flavors, very interesting. From, you know, that's my flavor profile, is, you know, all of it, you know, coastal, you know, Mediterranean, France, Italy, Spain, Eastern Mediterranean, North Africa. Mm. Like all those flavors, like the citrus, the anchovies,
the
salt, all of it.
You know, as I was saying to you, I went to Israel for the first time a couple of weeks ago. You know what they serve for breakfast? You know, you get the continental breakfast.
Right.
Yeah, and they come up to you. A huge plate of chopped salad. They have salad for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was blown away. I thought, these are my kind of people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It was really, so yes, Mediterranean influence. So at Leverhouse, you really got a lot of accolades. I mean, that's really when your star shot up. And how was that? I mean, was that something that the room expected? Because, you know, they were going against the Four Seasons. I remember when it opened, there was all this. Is Leverhouse going to draw away the Power Lunch? How much pressure was on you to because they could make a beautiful room, but if people weren't comfortable with your food in the actual living room of the restaurant.
Right. I mean, I think the pressure on me was the pressure I put on myself. I just wanted to make delicious food.
Mm-hmm.
That I felt good about putting on plates. And I think that, you know, I'm not an avant-garde guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it should be, I don't think that food, for me personally, I don't think it should be challenged. You know, I don't want to make something that people have to scratch their head and go, oh, well, okay, I guess that makes sense. I'll wait a second. It's really, I mean, it's just like, for me, I don't want to say it's straightforward. It's a line from point A to point B, but, mm-hmm. I like that it should be recognizable. I think that, you know, and I think that most successful chefs, the idea is that whatever is the center of the plate should be the focus of attention. Mm-hmm. But for me, I like to make it as delicious as possible, mm-hmm. and recognizable, because I think that for me personally, that's where it's at. And I got to do that. And, you know, I couldn't really worry too much about the Four Seasons. Just wanted to make nice food, and people, you know, people really responded well to it.
They really did.
Yeah.
They really did. So then, we're running out of time, and I want to get down to where you are. No, don't worry.
Okay.
There's no hard stop on the internet radio, you know, so we're going to get there. But I want to get to where you are today. So I know from Lever House you went to Standard, and now Standard too. So tell me about your evolution and how, you know, like how you see yourself and your food, and what
right.
was the challenge and what was the joy of the Standard. And what are you going to be doing at the Regent?
Well, I think the challenge at the Standard was going from a 100-seat restaurant to going to this hotel with 360 rooms and so many different outlets, and organizing that and making great food consistently and executing that. And I think I did that.
Yeah, I think you did too.
And that in itself was a great challenge, and it was awesome. And then the opportunity to work at the Regency presented itself, and
now they've redone the hotel.
They have,
they're changing their whole
reopened. We reopened January 16th, mm-hmm. and so we are what's today, the 11th or the 12th?
Yeah, the 12th of March.
Yeah, so we're not even quite 8 weeks into it, and it's been great. I mean, the Tisch family's great. Lowe's is a great company. The room for the Regency Bar and Grill is wonderful, comfortable. It's open on two sides. It's open on Park and 61st. So when you walk by, you can see the dining room, see everybody.
Oh, so they changed that? Huh?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's great. It came out really well.
How many seats?
We have about 100 seats, 120.
Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do there?
We are doing, you know, we're doing, it's an American bar and grill, whatever the hell that means. So, you know, I think that the food is, you know, the food is recognizable. We have great steaks. We have, you know, get great fish. You know, I'm kind of pulling from all of the vendors and purveyors and utilizing the relationships that I've developed over the course of the years.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to spring, quite honestly.
Mm-hmm, I know. Well, enough with the root vegetables.
It'll be nice to see some green things.
Yeah.
So we're starting to think, you know, trying to start to think about the spring.
So tell me something on the menu that really defines you today, where your head is at.
Well, let's see. I think that we have, you know, we're the menu is coming along really nicely. I think that, you know, we have, there's a great grilled duck breast on the menu at dinner that we do with black barley and a cherry, you know, a red wine cherry puree, a little mm-hmm. pistachio crumble.
Mm.
That's awesome. We just added an octopus dish to the menu as well. Grilled octopus with white beans, roasted butternut squash, fall, winter.
Mm.
Chorizo sofrito.
You're so sick of this winter.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, that all sounds delicious.
Yeah.
You know, the only good thing about lousy winters is eating the great food, the winter foods.
Yeah,
know?
No, and I'm a huge fan of, you know, like long braises and
mm-hmm.
and all that. But what I wouldn't give to see some, you know, some local asparagus or
mm-hmm.
dreaming of morels right now.
So, do you have a tasting menu or is it?
We don't have a tasting menu. I mean, we might do at some point. I think that we're going to start, the sommelier for the restaurant is, we're going to start doing some wine dinners
next month.
Yeah, we're going to get winemakers in.
What's your preference in wine? Are you agnostic to country or do you, you know, is it a very...
It's got to be good.
That's true. And you don't need those calories.
Yeah, you know, and whether it's a $15 bottle of wine or a $150 bottle of wine, as long as it's good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's, you know... I suppose it's easy to find a good $150 bottle of wine, but it's
That's hard to swallow, though.
It's much more of a trick to find a really delicious $15 bottle of wine, although there are plenty out there.
Yeah, there are. Plenty, so that's why you need a good sommelier.
Yes.
So, so what is it that you want people when they leave the Regency? What do you want them to feel, other than it was a delicious meal?
I want them to feel like they have to come back.
That's a good feeling. Is this the food that you're making? Because in that area of town, it's very residential.
Yes.
You do have people coming to that hotel, but I think it's an iconic hotel where a lot of business people come.
Yeah.
It's a lot of repeat business. These aren't tourists coming to New York once and looking for the New York experience. So is the menu something that you could eat three times a week?
God, I hope so.
Okay, no. I mean, I could not go to Per Se or,
Right, no.
Danielle.
It's more than... A couple of times a year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they're... And quite frankly, tasting menus, I can't do. I don't have the time for them.
Right.
I don't, but to have a great market-driven...
I mean, I think that there's arguments on both sides for a la carte versus tasting menus.
Mm-hmm.
I think that tasting menus are great if you have the time and the energy to invest in them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of times, and people use different restaurants for different things, as I said earlier. I think that, we are in an amazing residential neighborhood, and I think that a lot of people in our neighborhood, which is, Park Avenue in the 60s, come frequently.
Mm-hmm.
One
questions if they even have a kitchen in their house, in their apartment.
Oh, they all have kitchens. They probably, some of them might not use them, but
right.
They use ours.
Right. That's even better.
Exactly.
That's even better. Tell me what you think the other elements in the restaurant are important for the chef to have control of that's not necessarily the kitchen. Do you think the chef has to be involved with the decor? Do you think they have to be involved with the wine service and the bartender? Is it best to have the chef in charge of the kitchen, the whole restaurant, or, how does that work?
I mean, there are probably some people who are capable of that. I think you have to. I mean, if you have the energy to invest in that, that's great. Otherwise, I would say hire somebody who you can get along with, who's knowledgeable, whose work ethic and sensibility you trust to do that. I think that there are enough things to deal with in a kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I like to be involved in the service aspect of how the food is brought to the table because firm believer in working hand in hand with the front of the house staff because they're my representatives.
That's true.
They're the people who are on the front lines selling food, selling wine, and promoting what we do. And so we try and work really closely with them to give them all of the tools that they need and try and share the knowledge about whatever the products, the preparations, the presentations, so that they can advocate for us with the guests.
So, as I said, we're running out of time here.
Boo.
So, one last thing.
Yes.
If, as I said, there's a lot of people who listen to this program, a lot of diners as well. But I try to gear the program to young chefs and culinary students and what they should glean from you and your experience. If we could distill your philosophy that you would give to a young chef, what are some of the things you would say to them?
Eat out, read cookbooks, and cook. And don't be afraid to make mistakes.
That's great.
Because I think it's all about learning, and it's an endless learning adventure.
That's great.
And as long as you keep your eyes open and keep your head down and hands moving, then you can get to where you want to go.
So glad you're saying that at the school here. It's exactly the way we think. Well, thanks so much for coming.
You're welcome.
Really,
thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. Same here. Take care. I'd like to thank everybody involved with this program, especially Robin Cohen, who's very essential as my producer here. So this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.